Support for this podcast is made possible in part by our members. Become a member of WNTI by visiting our ePledge page at WNTI.org.
You're listening to Contours, WNTI's Issues and Arts program. Now your host, Melanie Teal.
Good morning and welcome to this week's edition of Contours. Today, Bill Nutt has two interviews. Geneva Magnus will be at the Stanhope House on the 30th of August, and Roger Glover from Deep Purple. The band Deep Purple will be at the Mayo Performing Arts Center on Sunday, August 24th. And first up, Dr. Carl Recco has our Centenary Corner for the month. Thanks for joining us today. Enjoy the show.
Hello, I'm Carl Recco for WNTI's Centenary's Corner. We interview Centenary College administrators, teachers, and students in important events that are happening here on the college campus. From August 4th, 2014 to August 8th, 2014, Centenary College will host a Fulbright Gateway orientation for 70 newly arrived Fulbright foreign students. The purpose is to gain understanding of the U.S. academic system and the American culture. Our guests are Mary Kirk, who is from the State Department. I'll be talking to her very shortly. Nancy Paffendorf, who is the Dean for Community and College Relations here at the college. And with them are three students who are here in the program itself, and they're from different countries, and we'll introduce them as we go along. First, we'll talk to Mary Kirk over here and ask her what the purpose is of this Fulbright Gateway Orientation Program.
Well, thanks very much. I'm Mary Kirk. I'm the with the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs of the U.S. Department of State, which is the sponsor of the Fulbright program. The program is funded by an annual appropriation from the U.S. Congress, and there are many partner governments that contribute significantly to the program. 75 incoming Fulbright graduate students are here at Centenary College in Hackettstown, New Jersey, for several days of orientation to the Fulbright program and also to the United States. And they are among 2,000 incoming new Fulbright students who will be studying, teaching languages, and doing research in the United States this year. So we're delighted to have them here, and I'm glad that they can join this interview.
Yeah. How long has this program been in effect?
It was founded in 1946 by Senator J. William Fulbright, who introduced the legislation that founded the program into the United States Senate.
Oh, okay. Well, it's been for quite a while then, and I'm sure it's been successful. Otherwise, it wouldn't be continuing at this point.
Absolutely. It's our flagship educational exchange program.
Okay, next we'd like to speak to our other guest here, who is Nancy Paffendorf, and she's the dean here of the Community and College Relations at the college. And what about the program here in terms of what are some of the subjects that are taught?
Well, we have a very full schedule, and things like cross-cultural understanding and adjustment are taught, appropriate interpersonal relationships, understanding U.S. academic culture. There are sessions on networking and team building and leadership. We also had a session today on U.S. politics and people.
Oh, it sounds quite interesting. It covers a whole range of topics.
Big range of topics that help the students from other countries adjust to the culture and the education in the United States.
Are there any other host sites?
We're one of nine host sites this year.
Really?
Around the country.
That's quite a bit. Yeah, and
and this is our third year of hosting the Fulbright Gateway Orientation.
Oh, third year. I see. And it is successful, as we can see so far. Okay, now, how about the idea of providing for these students some kind of activity, for example, like maybe setting up some trips for them? Do anything like that taking
place? We have two trips happening. On Wednesday afternoon, we will be going to Bethlehem Steel Stacks. There will be a tour of the former Bethlehem Steel plant, and then some time for listening to music, and their music fest is on this week. They'll be able to choose the food they'd like to eat and listen to some music and have some social time.
Now, what time do they start the program, actually, in getting involved in these events? Is there like a time schedule they go through?
Full day, every day. We start at 8 o'clock in the morning, and we finish up somewhere between 8:30 and 9:30 in the evening.
That's quite a day.
It's a very full day, and the students have come, many of them a very long distance, so they come a little bit tired and do very, very well with this heavy schedule.
Now, when you say a long distance, you mean from
The countries area? That they just came in on Monday were their first stop in the United States. So we have people coming in from all over the world.
So they have to get acclimated to a certain extent before they begin,
I would
imagine.
Yes, they do.
Or while they're in the program, becoming acclimated, which is a hard thing to do. I have trouble just going to California and getting acclimated once I get
that
there.
That three-hour difference.
Right, and then coming back. Wow, that's pretty rough. Okay, so they come here, and they're here for what, 4 days, is it?
They come on Monday, they leave on Friday, and it's three intensive days of study and trips.
Wow, yeah, I can imagine.
The other trip we do is the Winneconne Village at Waterloo Village.
Ah, what's that?
It's the Indian village that shows the history of life in this area back to when the Indians were in residence.
Ah, okay. So they get some information about our past history in terms of our Native Americans that were here before we were.
Correct.
Ah, that's quite interesting. So there's a full span of history that is provided to them, I would imagine, to get a better picture of, like you say, like I said before, the idea of the American customs and what happens here in terms of our academic life as well.
Yes.
Ah, okay. Now we'll get to our students. I think we better get to them because they're the ones we should be asking questions of since they're taking part in the program. And we'll start with them introducing their names first.
Hi, I'm Rohit Tak. I'm an architect from India, and I'm here to study urban design in the University of California at Berkeley.
Oh, so you're going to Berkeley, California. Yeah. Then each one of you are going to different colleges after this to take a full program at those colleges. Oh, okay, I see. Architect, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. So maybe I can contact you in the future to build a house for me.
Whatever. I'll be learning how to build cities. So, yeah, in case you have a plan to build a city, do contact.
Well, you're a fool around. You're a mess around with houses. You build whole cities. Wow. Hey, that's good. So will you apply this when you return back to India?
Well, the procedure started in last June, where we submitted our online applications. And after that, it took around eight months or something to when we actually got informed that we have got selected. And the procedure was sort of lengthy, and we had to keep a lot of patience as we had to also appear for interviews to get selected for this candidature. And after that, we appeared for GREs and TOEFL, all these exams, and applications were sent to the universities. So the entire process took 1 year.
1 year, huh?
Yeah.
Now, that's true, I guess, of all the students that are taking part in the program, huh? Yeah. All right, now, what part of the program are you the most enthusiastic about?
For the gateway orientation?
Yes.
Visiting the local, the native locality.
Oh, so you're looking over the area, trying to see what's here, what's going on, and so on. And maybe how it compares to what's going on in your culture as well, I would imagine, huh?
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, and what are you enjoying in terms of your courses?
Here, I enjoyed the first part of the, like today was the first day, the networking and how to build relationships with each other and with the university and whatever the information we got. We got informed that was interesting. And apart from that, the informative sessions are also interesting.
I suppose what might be interesting too is the idea of networking with other students in the program itself.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's good. That's an important thing to meet people from other cultures to find out how they live their lives and so on and so forth, what their plans are for the future. That'd be interesting. Okay, we're going to our second student now. I can't see it. I got to look behind this. Hi.
Hi. My name is Reem Harp. I'm from Lebanon, and I will be pursuing a master's degree in Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Texas at Austin.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's all set up for you then. You can simply, after you complete this program, go over to the University of Austin, you said, at Texas, in Texas, huh?
Yes.
Oh, okay. And what part of this program were you the most enthusiastic about?
Meeting the other Fulbrighters and talking to them, seeing what they're interested in, especially getting to know their cultures. There are people from countries I've never met before, places I've never been. So it's really interesting to compare experiences.
Hmm. How do you intend to use the information you obtain when you go to the University of Austin?
Well, my major will be in Middle Eastern Studies, and although I will be mainly focusing on history and politics, I'm also allowed to take courses that are more cultural or related to anthropology. So it will be really interesting to discuss whatever information I receive here from the other Fulbrighters in these courses.
And what part of learning any information about America here sort of impressed you the most?
My sister's has been living in the U.S. for 10 years, so I'm already familiar with U.S. culture because I've been here on several visits before. And I'm sure I will experience cultural shock like any other student because I will be living here for the first time for a really long time. But so far with the with the orientation, it's I haven't really been exposed to something different about American culture.
Oh, okay. So you're familiar with it to a certain extent.
To a certain extent. So for now, it's been okay.
No surprises, huh?
For now.
You had the surprises originally when you came here.
Yes. I'm sure that will change, though, when I start living here.
Oh, quite interesting. Oh, okay. And how about a third student?
My name is Roberto. I'm from Chile, from Santiago.
Oh, okay.
And I will be studying an LLM, a Master's of Law, at Columbia University in New York.
Oh, going to be a lawyer, huh?
I am a lawyer. An LLM is a master's of law for people who already have a law degree from another country that is not the U.S.
Ah, okay. So after the show, then, I have some problems. Could I ask you information about law?
If you have some legal problems back in Chile, you could ask me all the information you want. However, we'll have to finish our LLM before I can help you with any U.S. legal issues.
Well, you can give me some ideas anyway.
Well, yeah, definitely. Yeah, I can give you some ideas, yeah.
Now, what about the program here? What impressed you the most about the program and what you became enthusiastic about?
It's been a very, very friendly environment. We've had a lot of fun, I think, with my fellow students. I was very impressed to see that there are other law students and prospective LLM students here. So I was glad to meet them and to exchange some information on the programs, on the courses they will be taking, etc.
Oh, okay. And you've got your future planned, I see. What college are you or university will you be going to?
I'm going to Columbia University,
Columbia.
New York City.
Ah, okay, okay. That's all set up for you then. And now, what about the trips? What did you find the most interesting so far? Have you been on any trips so far that you?
Oh, no, we haven't been on any trips.
Oh, I haven't been on trips yet. Oh, okay. All right.
Tomorrow and the next day.
Oh, okay. So we have any idea what the trips might be? I'll go to Nancy here. And,
as we talked about the steel stacks in Bethlehem and Waterloo Village. So we'll have to ask that question afterwards.
Afterwards. Oh, okay. Maybe there's a return. I don't know. Okay, well, I wish you all good luck at this point, and maybe we'll get back to Nancy once more and ask a few points of information about the program itself. And how long have you been in the program, Nancy?
Well, this is our third year hosting.
Oh, you've been in
the
third year yourself.
It's the third year that we've hosted, and we're very excited to have these wonderful students here. It's great for us as well. We learn about culture, about their culture, as they're learning about ours, and you know, these are really bright and wonderful individuals, and it's a real privilege to have them here on the Centenary College campus.
Yeah. We're talking about the Fulbright Gateway Orientation Program here at Centenary College. just to bring you up to date here. And I'd like to go back to Mary Kirk from the State Department and ask information of her to a certain extent. And that would be, for example, at the State Department level, how long have you been there?
2 years.
2 years. Oh, okay. So you've learned a lot in 2 years, I would imagine, huh?
Yes, I have.
And what's your impression of the program itself as you see it?
Well, I think that I would like very much to hear from our students about their career plans and what they're going to do when they return home. This is a leadership development program and a program that fosters mutual understanding between the United States and 155 countries around the world.
Oh.
And these are preeminent examples of our scholarship recipients who are extremely talented, already have a distinguished record of leadership in their home countries, and have been chosen because of their for our scholarship because of the fact that they will be leaders in them when they return home. So perhaps they'd say a few words about their chosen career paths and what they'll do with their U.S. higher education.
Okay, so we'll go back to our first student. And name again?
Yeah, I'm Rohit. Well, I hail from India. I came here in the United States to study because U.S. being a developed country, and my field of study is urban design. I'll get to do a lot of case study, get to learn a lot of the out of the developed public spaces, the city design part of it, the public amenities, infrastructure-related issues. And these all aspects which I'll study here, I can use all these principles and the crux of it to develop the spaces in India. So that is the motto of why I'm here to study. Apart from that, I would like to talk about what I learned here in the United States culture in India and try to contribute towards the mutual understanding between both countries.
What did you learn from the culture?
So far, well, this is my second day in the U.S., but yeah, I'm sure in this one span of 1 year, I learn a lot.
Okay. So you need more time to develop some kind of reaction to what you're learning about the culture, I suppose,
exactly.
And perception of what's going on as well.
Exactly.
All right. Again, the second student.
Yes. Hi.
Introduce yourself.
I'm Reem Harp from Lebanon, and I'll be studying Middle Eastern Studies. After I graduated from university, I decided to gain some work experience that's related to the field of politics because I did my BA in literature. And during those years, it was when the Arab uprising started in the region, and the Middle East became a really hot topic all of a sudden, and there were many debates locally, regionally, and internationally on the conflicts that erupted in my region, and as well as debates on whether the West should intervene or not and how to. And it was really interesting to hear so many different perspectives on the topic, and I really wanted to pursue a deeper study of the region, of the history, and of the politics, but also in the context of an interactive program where I would be able to share my views on the politics in my country, in the region, but also listen to the views of other people, especially in the USA, because of its influence as an international actor on the region as well. So I'm really hoping that after I pursue this degree, I can return home and work for either an international organization or a research center that can strategically influence policy in the region, and to use whatever expertise or knowledge I learn, especially because the Middle Eastern study centers in the U.S. are some of the best in the world. And so I'll have the chance to learn a lot and hopefully use this information, these skills back home.
Oh, well, fantastic. That's really interesting. And wish you luck, of course, in your
Thank
endeavors.
You.
And how about the third student again, the lawyer?
Yeah, my name is Roberto. I will be studying an LLM at Columbia, Masters of Law. My plan is to make a contribution back home. Back home, I teach civil law, which is the backbone of the legal education there. It's a basic course in law. And I intend to put a comparative perspective on the common law issues I will learn at Columbia. I plan to focus on torts and contracts and the basic regulation of those issues in order to bring that experience back home. I also plan to have an international business component to my studies, as my past practice has focused on international business transactions. So I plan to grab that experience from the international perspective of law at Columbia and bring it back home to help me on my private practice also.
Oh, okay.
Other than teaching.
Oh, nice. And again, good luck to you as well in your endeavor in the future, your future career. I'd just like to find out what kind of selection process do they have to go through to become participants in the Fulbright Gateway program?
Selection for the Fulbright program in general is very competitive all over the world. We also, as you know, have a competition process in the United States for American citizens who receive scholarships every year. Worldwide, the program is extremely competitive. In the United States, we received for the graduate student program, the postgraduate program, 12,000 applications for 2,000 spots this year. And we also have a program that serves American faculty who go abroad to teach or to do research. But in each of the countries where these young people competed for their awards, it was a very stiff competition as well nationally in those countries. The hallmarks of the program are open and merit-based selection for the program.
Well, thank you. Our interview is over, and I'd like to thank you all for being here, and we learned a lot about the Fulbright Gateway Orientation Program being held here at Centenary College. Talking to our guests, Mary Kirk from the U.S. State Department, and also Nancy Paffendorf, who is the dean here in charge of or running the program that deals with the community and college relations. Well, thank you very much for being all. And we also had three students from various countries, as you've heard. They're participants in this program, and they spoke a lot about what they intend to do in the future and maybe how much information they're getting from being members of the program, students participating in this program. Well, thank you all very much.
Direct Millwork LLC of Washington, New Jersey, a building materials supplier featuring interior and exterior millwork products, including custom doors, moldings, windows, and decking and railing systems. Information on Direct Millwork services available online at directmillwork.com or by phone 908-223-7293. Direct Millwork is a proud sponsor of WNTI Stage.
Jonathan Magnus is a star of the blues world. You don't believe me? Take it up with the Blues Foundation, which in 2009 named her the B.B. King Entertainer of the Year, only the second woman up to that point to get that honor, the first being Coco Taylor. Not too bad company to be in. That's on top of all the other awards she has accumulated over the years. She has released her latest album is called Original. She's going to be coming to the Stanhope House, I'm happy to say, on the 30th of August. I'm even happier to say that she is on the other end of the line with us. Jonava, welcome to the WNTI airwaves.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for the support. I appreciate it.
Let's start by talking about the new CD. It's called Original, and I'm sure that title was chosen very carefully.
Thank you for saying that. It really is called Original because it's 11 original songs. I'm co-writer on 7 of those 11 tracks, and that's a huge step out for me. You know, the whole album, the whole release is a huge step out for me on multiple levels. So, yeah.
Is it that you've been reluctant to co-write so many songs on a project, or was it that you were nervous, or why do you feel that this is a milestone for you?
I didn't want to write. I never wanted to be a songwriter. I didn't want to do it like Sylvester the cat would resist something. You can just get that visual, you know.
Yes, I can.
I did not, you know, writing your own material is such a different wheelhouse of vulnerability. It's a different wheelhouse of intimacy. And but, I just didn't want to do it. I was married to a very prolific songwriter for a very, very, very long time. I had, you know, what I jokingly referred to was in-house, you know.
Right.
An in-house songwriting staff. I just didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. And it became necessary to, as we say, get up off that posture, to change that thinking. And I'm sorry.
No. Was there any one song that maybe kind of opened the floodgates, one that when you got that done, you said, okay, I can do this, and then move on?
No, I'm still not there yet. I'm still not to the, okay, I can do this. and all the anxiety and all the reluctance and all the fear goes away. I'm not there. It's probably going to take me, you know, another 20 years for that. I'm on a slow learning curve. But I will tell you this, that here's what's been the loudest for me. I think of it as something that's very, very loud from the universe, you know, big flashing neon signs, people with megaphones yelling, that kind of loud, you know. When the previous release on Alligator, Stronger for It, mm-hmm. I had three co-writes with my producer, Dave Darling, who's wildly talented. And those three songs got the most radio airplay, it turned out, were the songs that were most embraced by all the fans. And I can't articulate to you what it's like to step out on stage to a packed house and begin to sing an original song. And from the very first word, you can hear and see the audience singing along. Mm. It's like a whole other reality, Bill. And then to have the Blues Foundation nominate one of those songs for Song of the Year, and then to walk away with that hardware to actually win that last year. Mm-hmm. All of that, you kind of, you know, is really loud, dude. It's loud.
I would think that you would need 20 years after that. I mean, when you get an award, isn't that enough? I mean, but I can understand. Did you feel that you were, I don't want to say standing on the shoulders of giants, but did you feel like a certain feeling of the blues is such a rich tradition, and there have been so many phenomenal blues writers, and there are so many amazing blues songs. Did that kind of give you pause? Was that part of it?
What I felt like was like I was standing in some really high cotton, standing in some really tall cotton. And it's humbling for me to be held up in that way. It's frightening for me, honestly, to be held up in that way, but that's okay. I'll take it. I'll take it. I'd much rather have that kind of fear than the fear of, you know, not knowing where my next meal is coming from, or the fear of wondering whether or not I'm going to be safe sleeping in a cardboard box in an alley. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
And I go to that because that's the reality for so many of citizens in the world, for so many American citizens. And it is the reality, you know, it could have been my reality. It could have been my reality. And I shall never forget that.
Well,
but it's not, you know, it's not today that my, you know, my quality problems are, how am I going to navigate feeling so frightened about the good news?
We're talking with Jonava Magnus, and you touched on something, and we won't go there if you'd rather not, but if it comes to singing the blues, you've got stuff to draw from.
I do. You know, everybody's got a story. I've got one, too. It's very true that, you know, there's been a lot of publicity in the last 15 years about the earlier part of my life, because I came to realize through the help of a friend that if I was more open about some of my history, that it was possible that it might actually serve it might actually serve to help somebody else. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that that's true. It turns out that that's accurate. It turns out, Bill, that by being more open about the earlier part of my life, which was pretty bumpy, not as bad as some other people I've known, but bumpy enough, that it actually has helped to make that earlier crooked road make more sense, because it does serve to help other people to be open about the fact that I'm alumni of foster care, to be open about the fact that I was orphaned as a young girl, my parents both committed suicide, to be open about, you know, being a homeless teenager and getting pregnant and having a daughter and giving her up for adoption, to be open about those kinds of details, because the fact of the matter is that that part of my life, it no longer defines my days and nights. And it used to. It used to. It doesn't anymore. And so there's been a tremendous healing here. And then, you know, that begets the question, what happened? How did I get so lucky? How did I get so lucky? And there's two very, very straightforward, simple answers to that. One is the music, which has served to heal me and hold me. And the other one is because somebody stood up for me when I couldn't stand up for myself. And it completely changed the trajectory of my life. You know, if that... Mm-hmm. People hear me talk about this. I talk about it a lot. You know, you stick a mic in front of me and I'm going to talk about it, because it is my job now, part of my job, to encourage and inspire more good people to step forward for youth at risk. We need more good people to step forward. That's where the healing begins. That's how the healing occurs, because we are changed. We are saved as youth at risk, quite literally, Bill, in seconds and inches. It's remarkable.
Well, I know
it's
that
beautiful.
Among the things that you do is, I know you're a spokesperson for the Casey Family Programs, and I know you've done other work besides simply talking about it. You put your money and your talent where it can be noticed in those causes.
Thank you. Yeah, I am honored to stand as a spokesperson for National Foster Care Month through Casey Family Programs, which we, of course, celebrate all year long. I am honored to stand as an ambassador for Foster Care Alumni of America and as an ambassador for Child Welfare League of America. So those are all huge honors and quite daunting responsibilities, you know.
In all that, in all those early years, when did you realize, and I believe this is a story that you've told before, but I'd like to hear you talk about your first exposure to the blues and what attracted you to the blues as a genre.
It's the only music that's ever made any sense to me. And I don't think I chose it. I think it chose me. I think it took me hostage in the very best way possible. I think it took me. I think it snatched me up and has never, ever loosened its grip. You know, do I listen to soul music, heavy soul music? Absolutely. Do I listen to R&B? You bet. Do I listen to folk music, which really... blues used to be called folk music, mm-hmm. American folk music.
Sure.
You know, absolutely. Am I categorized, am I put in a category by the Blues Foundation as a contemporary blues artist? Absolutely. And I think that that's completely right and true and accurate. And I'm just, I couldn't be more grateful for it, because it gave me a place to belong. And I didn't belong anywhere.
Do you see yourself at some point expanding that vocabulary that you've worked to develop, especially with your writing? Do you see yourself dipping more into R&B? Do you see yourself into soul or even gospel or folk? Or is that, that's 40 years down the line. 20 more years to get comfortable as a writer. Right?
You know, I think that the accurate answer to that is that I never want to make the same record twice. Some people, some artists have entire careers where they make basically the same record over and over again, and that works really fine and well and good. I'm not that kind of a person. I'm not that kind of an artist. I want to move forward. I don't want to make the same record twice. So my experience of it is as if I'm evolving and moving forward and embracing the folk aspect of blues, which is now, by the way, referred to as Americana.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If we want to be current, we call that Americana. And embracing the soul and R&B, you know, aspects, and even touching on a little bit of the rock aspects of blues. All of those genres, all of those titles are all tap-rooted in the blues.
Right.
In my view. Now, there's something else I want to say here. There are two women that I deeply admire and who I hold very high, who I look up to, two living artists that I look up to. Mavis Staples, Betty LaVette.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's the deal with Mavis. Here's the deal with Betty. And I'm graced, I'm gifted to actually know both of those women. They do what they damn well please. It doesn't matter where the song comes from. It doesn't really matter the genre that it comes from. You know that, you know, Betty LaVette doesn't care that I Got My Own Hell to Raise is a Fiona Apple song.
Right.
It doesn't matter to her. It doesn't matter to her that, you know, one of her most popular recordings, she's backed up by the Drive-By Truckers. That doesn't matter to her either.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter to Mavis as she's covering a Levon Helms song. That doesn't matter to her.
Right.
There's nobody taking her to task for that.
It doesn't, now, it doesn't matter that she works with Ryan Adams or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, here's what I love about that. What those women are doing is choosing material, finding material, creating material, co-creating material that speaks to their soul, and then they can bring themselves. Mavis brings herself to the song.
Mm-hmm.
Betty brings herself to the song. And in the case of those two women, then pretty much they own that song, and that's the end of that.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? It's like Aretha Franklin when she covers a song. You just better leave it. Just leave it.
Yeah.
Don't try. Don't even go there, because whatever it is,
you're never gonna. Wasn't that what Otis Redding said that one time? That little girl stole my song, and he, of course he laughed about it. But
yes. You know, so. I look up to that. I hold that very high. I want to try and touch that. It's not that I think that I'm standing next to those women, because I certainly don't, but I so admire that, and it's such an inspiration to me on so many levels, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're talking with Jonathan Magnus. Now, let's talk about the Stanhope House. Tell us a little bit about what you plan on playing. Are you one of those people who has your set list all planned out, or are you really instinctive?
Yes.
Okay.
I do have a planned out set list, and then we see how it feels when we're in that room. I love the Stanhope House. I'm so happy to be coming back there. I'm really excited about it. So I really hope folks can make it out, because we don't make it, first of all, to the East Coast all that often, and we haven't been to the Stanhope House in quite a while. So really looking for folks to come out. We are going to be playing all of the new record and more.
I should mention that you definitely have a place here on WNTI. Your last several records have been part of the rotation here, and you've got a lot of fans among the staff and among the listeners. So, Jonava, thank you very much for sharing your talent with us, and thank you doubly for taking the time to speak with me today and to forthrightly answer your questions.
You bet, man. I appreciate the support so much, and I really look forward to seeing you at the show. So.
To remind you, Jonava Magnus will be performing at the Stanhope House on Saturday, August 30th. For more information, you can go to stanhopehousenj.com. Jonava's new album is called Originals, and it is original, sorry, singular.
Yeah.
And and you can find it, I'm assuming, in all the usual places now. What is usual for 2014, which wasn't usual for when you started recording?
Absolutely. You could certainly find it on JanovaMagnus.com. You can get it on iTunes and Amazon and all the what are considered today the normal retailers. You bet. It's all there.
Thank you again, Jonava.
And you can get it at the show, by the way. You can get it at the show, Bill.
Well, there you go. Thank you again, Jonava. Good luck with everything. For Contours and for WNTI, this has been Bill Nutt.
All Seasons Recreational Vehicles of Easton, Pennsylvania. Located on Route 248, All Seasons RV offers new and used RVs for sale and parts and service for Winnebago RVs and trailers and surveyor trailers. More information available online at allseasonsrvs.com or by phone 610-253-7700. All Seasons Recreational Vehicles, a proud supporter of WNTI Stage.
Few people would argue that when it comes to heavy metal, hard rock, one of the most influential bands is Deep Purple. Happily, Deep Purple is still out there, still making new music. They just came out with an album last year called Now What? And several of the original members, or longtime members, I should say, are still with the band. They're going to be coming to the Mayo Performing Arts Center on Sunday, August 24th. On the other end of the line is the man whose bass playing anchors the group. It's a pleasure for me to say, Roger Glover, welcome to the WNTI airwaves.
Well, thank you very much. That sounds like a lovely introduction.
Well, I used heavy metal and hard rock. Did you ever think in those terms when you guys were making your music, or was it just rock?
Well, we certainly didn't think of heavy metal, no. Hard rock was or blues rock. We were on Harvest, which was a progressive label. So in the early days, people called us a prog rock.
Right.
But hard rock was the name that we really adopted because that's what it felt like. And I remember feeling insulted when the Hard Rock Cafe opened. They've stolen our genre.
Who do they think they are?
Yeah, well, exactly. But then heavy metal came in, and heavy metal to me was, it was not hard rock. It was one element of hard rock that they'd taken and just exaggerated.
Mm.
And that was the angst and the screaming and the noise, you know. But hard rock is much more than that to me. It's an all-encompassing genre. There's as much jazz and classical in it as anything else. And I don't hear that with the... I mean, I suppose there are elements of it that go through, yes. Heavy metal. It's not music that is pleasant to my ears for the most part.
Mm.
I can appreciate the technicality of it. And in fact, some of those drummers are amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all a bit primitive somehow. And hard rock has more finesse than that, in my humble opinion.
Looking at the music you're making now and the way Deep Purple is playing now, what would you say is the biggest difference between Deep Purple circa 2014 and Deep Purple circa 1973, 1974?
The strange thing about Deep Purple has always been a spirit in the band that's remained the same. And I think that spirit was born out of the fact that in 1968-69, we were against the grain. We were kind of rebellious. The BBC would never play anything like this. And so there was a feeling that we just wanted to do what we wanted to do, and it had, really had to be coming from the music. And when we got success with that music, to me, that's a real success because you make it on your terms and not, you know, following everyone else. And to me, that was very important. And that spirit has remained. You know, obviously had our ups and downs as a band. But going into this last album, we had the same modus operandi. It, you know, it all comes from jams, it all comes from playing. It doesn't come from conscious effort to write songs. It just comes from the way we play. So that's pretty much the same. Of course, bodily we're different, and I think mentally we're probably very different. I look back at old videos and photographs and try to connect with the person that I was when I was 24. It's difficult.
Well, looking back then, and you weren't the original bassist, but you were there practically from the beginning. You and Ian Gillan had been part of Episode 6, I think, was your previous band, and then you joined. When you guys joined the band, what did you see as why were you excited to be part of Deep Purple at that time?
You know, I've been thinking recently about how this whole career that I've had, which has been amazing, all comes down to a very small little point, the point at which I met Purple. I mean, you can go further beyond that, the point at which I met Ian Gillan 4 years, 5 years before, etc. But that one moment, I was completely out of my depth. I didn't know who Deep Purple was. It was a year or so after they had Hush. And in fact, they did three albums in the first 12 or 13 months, I think.
Yeah.
So they were quite prolific. But I'd not heard of them. And through a connection, they came to know of Ian Gillan, and they offered him the job, and then they offered me the job, and I said, well, I can't take it because I can't leave my band. You know, since school, we've been together and up and down, and of course, changed my mind. And thankfully, I did. And, you know, those key moments in your life almost pass by imperceptibly without, you know, knowing what the import those decisions will make in future. So I've had this kind of philosophy now, just leave everything to chance because you can't control anything.
We're talking with Roger Glover of Deep Purple. You know, I can't let you go without asking about the song that I think every young guitar player who wants to play rock guitar learns how to play. Did you guys realize when you were writing and recording Smoke on the Water that it would become what it became?
In fact, it almost didn't get put on the album.
Really?
I won't go into the story about the fire, but the fire burned down the place where we were going to record.
Right.
And a couple of days later, we started recording in a nearby theater, small Art Nouveau-style theater. And after we'd got the sound together, we just had a jam. Richie started playing this riff, and we all kind of joined in. It was about midnight when we were actually recording a take of it. And unbeknownst to us, the police were knocking at the door to stop us because we were keeping the whole town awake. It's a very sleepy little town in those days.
In Switzerland, right, in the middle of nowhere.
We couldn't do anything there. So after a long search, 5 days or something, we found the hotel that was closed for the season and recorded the stuff there. So we concentrated on all the stuff that we recorded in the hotel, which was Highway Star and Pictures of Home, Space Trucking, and Maybe I'm a Leo, all those. And this one track that we'd recorded in the other place kind of got sort of forgotten. So anyway, we were running out of time because the fire had delayed our recording plans by over a week, and we only had 3 weeks. So we didn't have enough for an album, so we started looking at this one song. We'd poured all our efforts into a song called Never Before that we thought was going to be the single. And Smoke in the Water, it didn't have any vocals or anything yet. It was just one take. That was it. And I'd come up with the title just after the fire. One day I said to myself, Smoke in the Water, to no one in the room. There's no one else in the room.
Right.
Why I said that, I don't know. But And so Ian and I were figuring out what to do over the top of this mid-tempo, chugging sort of song. We thought, oh, let's write the story about what happened to the fire. So we just wrote it down very literally and thought nothing of it. It was a mid-tempo, None of us had a clue of what it was going to be. And that's another great part of success is it takes you by surprise. You never know the future of a song. So it's a great song to play. I mean, it's simple enough that we can actually have fun with it most every night. It's always slightly different.
How do you approach, now, as you mentioned, you know, time has passed, and when you play those songs from that era, what's different about them? Is your approach different? How do you, how do those songs sound now in 2014?
That's a very good question. I think there was a lot more mayhem in the old days. Richie, you know, magnetic performer, you never knew quite what he was going to do next. And that kept everyone on edge, and it resulted in some shows that weren't great and some shows that were brilliant. We're much more consistent now, probably because we've been doing it for so long. We really know the songs inside out. I don't actually think to compare it, really. I'm always in the moment. I'm always in the now. And it's great to play those songs because I can see people's faces smiling and recognizing. I think we're in actually a great position because we have new material and we have old material, and we have rarities. We have an enormous catalog to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a great position to be in. And they all sound great on stage. When you're playing them, you're in the moment. You don't think about the past. Well, thank you very much. And also thank you for not coming up with the usual questions like, what can they expect at the show? Are there any surprises?
Well, it wouldn't be a surprise then, would it?
Exactly.
But for Contours, this has been Bill Nutt.
That's it for this week's edition of Contours, your weekly roundup of what's happening in the WNTI listening area and the surrounding communities. Thank you to everyone who made today's show possible. Contours is a production of WNTI and can be heard Sundays at 9 a.m. with a rebroadcast on the website, WNTI.org.